Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. Thank you for joining us. My name is Mark Carey, in the hot seat, covering for Ali Maxwell for the final time. And we're here to fill in Chapter 3 of our World Cup notebook. The group games are nearly complete, and there's so much to talk about as ever. And I'm delighted to be joined by Michael Cox from Qatar. Michael, which game have you enjoyed the most since we last spoke?
I think it was probably last night. I was at Japan against Spain. I didn't see the comeback coming, despite the fact it was a very similar comeback to Japan's against Germany. And it was one of those crazy nights, of course, where everyone was trying to keep across two games. And not actually that much changed in the final 35, 40 minutes of Japan-Spain in terms of what was happening in front of me. But so much changed in terms of the situation in the other game. I mean, there was one point where it was Costa Rica and Japan going through. Which, I mean, that would have been, I think, one of the most extraordinary nights in the history of the World Cup, considering this was the group we were probably most confident about predicting. Yeah, it was an incredible group overall.
So many screenshots of the table as it stands of being Costa Rica and Japan both going through at one point. Ahmed Waleed is with us once again. Ahmed, are you looking forward to the jeopardy that we're about to enter with knockout football coming up very soon?
Yeah. And actually a couple of good games, I would say. So a couple of defense against attack games, but there are some good games.
Well, before we look forward, let's look back. Let's start with England, as we often like to do. 3-0 winners against Wales and convincing winners in Group B. And that means they face Senegal, who came second in Group A behind the Netherlands. Michael, you kept a close eye on all the African nations throughout this tournament. What have you made of Senegal? They've obviously been devastated to lose Sadio Mane on the eve of the tournament. They lost 2-0 in their first game, but they came back to finish second in Group A. Where do you think their strengths lie? And maybe where could they be got at?
Well, I think they're a very good side. We've seen that with their performance in the Africa Cup of Nations earlier this year. I think they're very well organised without the ball. They're strong in central midfield. I think they've been quite good so far at nullifying the opposition's main threats. They're obviously lacking a little bit without Mane in terms of creativity, but they do still have some very good runners on the break. And they've been tactically flexible as well. I mean, they went with two up front for their second game against Qatar, which proved very effective because both those strikers got on the score sheet. Back to one up front for the final game against Ecuador, and I don't think they'll deviate from that against England. So yeah, it's a relatively tough game for England. I think it's probably the one we expected. I think most people probably would have had that down as the most likely opponent in the round of 16. And if we're being honest, it's the kind of side that England, you know, should have to beat to get into the quarterfinal. They're exactly what you would expect from this level, a step up from what England encountered in the group stage. But yeah, England should start as favourites.
Yeah, and also I think it's good for England that Idrissa Gueye is suspended. I think he, alongside Kalidou Koulibaly and Ismaïla Sarr, were the best three players for Senegal. So him being suspending is huge for England because he showed up in all three games.
That's a very good point, actually, thinking about the idea of the starting lineup. And speaking of the starting lineup from an England perspective, we spoke in the last podcast about whether Gareth Southgate might switch to a back three in our previous episode of Our Notebook. And Michael, you wrote about this recently, saying that it could still be a feature for England if they progress through the tournament. It's almost, we're assuming a little bit that they might progress through against Senegal with maybe some ease, and we're thinking already into the further rounds of the knockout. But do you think this could still be a feature for England?
Yeah, I think that could well happen. I don't think it will happen against Senegal. I just don't think it really makes sense in terms of the specific tactics, or in terms of the fact that I think England will probably dominate possession. But I still think it's something that Southgate likes. I think he likes it against strong opponents. And if England were to encounter France, for example, later in the competition, if they get that far, I think the threat of France's wide players would mean potentially Southgate goes for a bit of extra insurance at the back. But yeah, I don't really see the need for it against Senegal.
Yeah, but it's interesting that I think the period where Senegal suffered the most, which is in the second half in the Qatar game, the first 20-25 minutes, it was because Qatar were using their wingbacks correctly, playing directly into their wingbacks. And we saw that in the Qatar goal. So yeah, I agree with Michael. It might not be this game, but just feel it's an interesting feature. And if not playing with three at the back, I think England should use their fullback well, like in the first game, because this is an area where I think Senegal might suffer.
One step at a time as well. Let's just overcome Senegal from an England perspective. But on the other side of Group A and B, I suppose, the United States beat Iran 1-0 in what was a thrilling game, actually. I really enjoyed watching this. So they have now drawn the Netherlands in the round of 16. Ahmed, you noted that the USA's left side rotations were key to their win. I think in general, their wide circulations on both flanks have been really quite interesting, and how that's changed throughout each game. But just talk us through what you saw tactically against Iran, and maybe how they could cause Netherlands damage in the upcoming game.
Yeah, I agree. The wide circulations are great. So when we watch teams, like Michael said a couple of podcasts ago, like the greatest praise we can say that they look like a domestic team. I think the US looks like a domestic team. So against Iran, because Iran were starting with a 4-4-1-1, the US circulation on the left with McKennie dropping and Anthony Robinson moving forward and Christian Pulisic going inside, the right center midfield for Iran, Ahmed Nourillahi, didn't manage. He can't go out towards McKennie in the left back position where McKennie was positioning himself, because that will create a gap in the center of midfield. So every time McKennie was in that back left back position, he had more time on the ball because Ahmed Nourillahi was afraid to go out and leave a gap in the center of midfield. And this allowed him time, and this time allowed McKennie to play those passes, whether to Robinson or to Dest, like we saw on the goal.
I think United States have been really exciting to watch. I looked at their numbers in terms of the percentage of on target shots that they've had, and I think they're among one of the lowest in the countries in the tournament so far. And I think they get into really good positions, especially in that Iran game. Ahmed, they were crossing a lot and they were getting some pretty high quality chances, but they just didn't convert. Do you think that's more of a chronic thing amongst the United States, or do you think that it's just you miss your chances sometimes? We've got a small sample size, because they seem to be getting into the right positions, but just not really converting.
Yeah, I think this is something they need to improve. But also, I think what's important, like when they were in possession, it helps with their counter-pressing, and John Mueller did a great piece on this. This is an aspect of their game that they're doing quite well. So maybe they're not creating as much chances like in terms of shots, but the opportunities are there. But it also means that they're still having the ball because of their counter-pressing. I'm really impressed with the tactical flexibility. So in three games, we saw different areas where they won the tactical battle. So in the first game, they lost it a bit in the second half with Wales going more direct. But in the first half, their pressing was amazing and Wales couldn't do anything. And because of their pressing, Wayne Hennessy kept going long, and one of those long balls meant that USA could, on the transition, get their goal. And then in the England game, I thought the role of Weston McKennie on the right side just caused England a lot of problems with him alternating between right midfielder, right winger. And then we saw, as we said before in the Iran game, the left side rotations. So also in terms of tactical flexibility, I think they're doing well. But yeah, I agree. They need to create more shots on target and shots in general.
Let's move on to Group C. Argentina managed to top the group after their poor start, a controversially poor start. And they're slowly building momentum, I think it's fair to say, Michael. I think it was easily their best performance so far against Poland. I looked into it and they're 23 shots with a joint second highest tally in a group stage game so far. And their 3.5 XG was the highest that Argentina have registered in a World Cup game since records began, which I thought was quite interesting. But was there anything different in this game for you, Michael, in terms of the way that Argentina went about the game?
Yeah, there was a change of system. Usually they play Messi as a kind of number 10 behind another striker. It's been Lautaro Martinez in the first two games. But here they played 4-3-3, really, with Messi as a false nine, his kind of old Barcelona role. They brought in Julian Alvarez to play on the left. So it was, yeah, there was a lot that was different about Argentina. Also played Enzo Fernandez in the holding role in front of the defence, who I think was excellent. I think he's probably nailed down that slot. I mean, he played very, very deep, almost like a... I was talking to James Horncastle, who's been doing the press conferences, and Scaloni described Argentina's system as at times featuring a false back three, which I haven't really heard that kind of phrasing before, but I kind of understand what he means. I mean, he was so deep, Fernandez. He was almost like a third centre back. And they were good. The thing that really stood out to me as much as the kind of the shape and the formation was just the aggression of Argentina. It was unlike anything I've seen in this tournament. I think it's been quite a standoffish tournament in a literal sense. I mean, there's been one red card in the entire tournament so far, which was a goalkeeper coming out and sweeping rather than a kind of outfield tackle. But Argentina were absolutely storming into these challenges. There were a couple that didn't even get penalised with a free kick, and yet I think sometimes they're the kind of tackles that you can see a yellow card being given for, even though the player got the ball, because they were just so ferocious. Depaul at one point really went in two-footed, but got away with it. And I think that is one of the notable things about this Argentina side. They can play. They're a really good team technically. Messi plays in such a unique way these days. But they can fight. And I think in a couple of knockout games, you know, they'll find a situation where it's scrappy and it's bitty and it's not about glamorous football. And I just feel Argentina can really dig in.
I think, as you say, Enzo Fernandez being key to the way that they're able to do that. Just 21 years old as well. I think he's got a massive future ahead of him at club level and at international level, of course, as well. And what is a great story here is that Argentina will be playing Australia in the round of 16, which is quite the story. Australia beating Denmark 1-0 in the final game, of course, finishing second in the group. I'm going to go back to XG again. They had the poorest XG for and against in the group. They had just 21 shots, which is comfortably the fewest of the other three sides in the group. But Michael, they are ultimately a pretty well-organised side, even if they aren't the most glamorous. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. At first, I'd like to tackle this XG thing, because I think they're being a little bit harshly treated here. I mean, they got thrashed against France, no doubt about that. But in all three games, they've taken the lead. And I haven't checked, but they might be the only team to have taken the lead in all three games when you consider some of the big sides have encountered nil-nils. And of course, in that situation, they end up sitting back and soaking up pressure and concede lots of shots. But certainly I was at the last two games where they kept two clean sheets against Tunisia and Denmark. And they absolutely deserved to keep clean sheets. They were not really, I wouldn't say they were hanging on. I wouldn't say the goalkeeper wasn't making miraculous saves. Okay, there was a lot of blocks and Harry Suter at the back was magnificent in both those games. So yeah, they deserve those two clean sheets in my view. They don't offer that much of a consistent attacking threat. But in both those games, they scored great goals. I mean, really, really good goals. The flicked header in the Tunisia game from Duke, and then Matthew Lecky's brilliant counter-attacking run and finish against Denmark. So I just, I mean, certainly can't dispute the numbers, but I don't feel like they've got away with it. I don't think they've got lucky or anything like that. I think they got soundly beaten against France. And even in that game, they started well in the first 20, 30 minutes. And then they deserved the victories over the next two opponents. So, yeah, I think they deserve enormous credit. I must admit, if we were at the start of the tournament, if we were listing in order the 32 teams we'd fancy to get through to the knockout stage, Australia would be quite close to bottom on my list. I thought it was quite a hard group. It's not a great squad in terms of, you look at the clubs they're playing for, they don't have a single Premier League player. And there was nothing from the qualification, really, which made you think they could be a force. I mean, they needed penalties in the playoff to get to this tournament. So it's been completely unexpected, but also completely deserved.
I think Michael states an important point, especially in these tournaments. And Mark, you're the numbers guy. So want to know what you think about this. But I think with this low sample size, game state comes into the equation. Because I watched the Tunisia-Australia game. I thought for the, like, before Mitchell Duke got his goal, actually Australia were better. They were very organized. Their left winger caused a lot of problems for Tunisia. And Tunisia just couldn't penetrate. But after the goal, like, Australia have to drop. So when they drop, they'll concede more chances. So I think game state comes into play when we're looking at the numbers as well.
I always like referring to XG where I can, but it's absolutely true that game state is massively important. And when someone, when a team, as Australia have done, overperform against their XG, if we are going to go off a small sample size, is it that they are almost better than the team who is underperforming against it because they're making the most of the chances that they do have? And Australia's, you know, it wasn't exactly end to end in any of Australia's games, but they did make the most of the opportunities they did have. And I think that was a real, is a real strength, and will help them in the knockout rounds, because they are ultimately, as we said, well organised and very solid.
Matt Leckie. No one's there with him. Leckie might go alone. Matt Leckie. What a moment for Australia.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
I'm going to move on to Poland. They progressed through Group C on goal difference, and it was almost via the fair play rule that they progressed by virtue of having collected two yellow cards fewer than Mexico. In the end, that was a redundant rule on the night Saudi Arabia scored a goal that meant that it was down to goal difference. But I just want to get your guys' thoughts on this rule. I know that this isn't the first time this has been introduced within this tournament, but just the fact that discipline is the deciding factor in progressing through the biggest tournament in the world, really. What do you guys make of it? I just want to get your thoughts.
Well, it is a bit weird, but I'm not sure what a better alternative is, really. If anyone's got an idea, I'm open to it, because, yeah, you shouldn't really be decided on cards, but I don't have a better suggestion.
Yeah, me too. I was going to say the same. Like, what are you going to do? Are you going to get the players from the other games to play a penalty shootout or something?
Well, I like that this is asked more questions than it's answered, because Adam Crafton, The Athletic's Adam Crafton, wrote this week about FIFA considering introducing penalty shootouts to decide whether teams should get a bonus point if the group stage games are drawn. This is when it's going to be expanded to 48 teams, I believe, for the World Cup in 2026. So, with that in mind, would you prefer that as the alternative?
So are the penalty shootouts before the game?
Well, this was one of my main gripes, that it could potentially be, well, it would have to be before the game, because there's talk of, it could lend itself to manipulation such that both teams could enter the final game knowing that, you know, however they want the game to pan out, that will be, you know, how it could pan out. So it would have to be before the game, which in itself seems quite strange. I don't think it's been fully, it's not quite oven-baked yet as an idea, but I do think, yeah, it's an alternative. It's something to discuss. And yeah, what did you guys think of it?
Yeah, but if it's before the game, it also doesn't lend itself to manipulation, but it lends itself that the players entering the game, they know, like, for example, that they won the penalty shootout. So if they drew or like not in the game score itself, if it's a draw at the end of the group, they have an advantage. So I think they'll play differently. So I just can't get my head around it, really.
Yeah, I don't think it works. I agree with Ahmed. I think it's quite sad, all this, really, because it's so obvious what has happened. FIFA have come up with the idea of 48 teams, and they haven't put any thought into how it will actually work. And now they're coming up with increasingly mad ideas to try and make it work. So I do find it quite depressing, especially when this group is this group stage has been such a good example of why the traditional 4-team format works so well.
Yeah, I think they said that in commentary of, you know, why change it? This is enough drama as it is. What is the need to change it? Yeah, I didn't say it was a great idea. I said it was an idea that FIFA are exploring. It seems quite strange, yeah, to have penalty shootouts.
How many games per day do you think they'll have when it's 48?
I'm already thinking of the radar. I'm already thinking of our pre-match or our pre-tournament previews, just how much we've got to cover with 48 teams. But let's not worry about that for now. Let's move on to Group F. Morocco topped the group after really not being given much of a chance of qualifying, I think it's fair to say, in a group containing Croatia and Belgium. They've become the first African nation to top a World Cup group since Nigeria in 1998. Ahmed, how impressed have you been with them?
Yeah, I think Morocco are one of the most organized teams off the ball in open play. They have some problems in defensive set pieces, but I'll come to that later. I think in open play, off-ball organization, they were brilliant in the three games. So in the first game, they managed to stop Croatia's trio in midfield of Modric, Brozovic, and Kovacic, and Modric had to drop really deep to get the ball. Then in the second game, against Belgium's 3-2-4-1, they managed to stop Hazard and De Bruyne by making their left fullback, Nusair Mazraoui, go inside to mark De Bruyne. And whenever Thomas Meunier, the right wing back of Belgium, wanted to advance, what happened is that Bouffal actually went inside to block the passing lane into De Bruyne. And this allowed Sofiane Amrabat to be free to mark Hazard on the other side, because Amrabat plays as a single pivot in Morocco's 4-3-3. And then, like yesterday against Canada started the game in something like a 4-4-2 or 4-4-1-1. They just couldn't penetrate Morocco's block. And then midway through the first half, Canada changed to a back three in possession. It caused Morocco some issues, but in the second half, I think the shifting of the markers from the Morocco players, because Morocco didn't change shape. They kept with the same shape until I think the last 15 or 12 minutes when they brought on another defender and moved to a 5-4-1. But their issue is in the defensive set pieces. Like we saw, Canada were going to equalize from a corner. I think Belgium had 2-3 chances against them from a corner. So in the next game, this is, I think, an area where you can exploit Morocco defensively.
Morocco facing Spain, being matched up against Spain, I think that'd be a really interesting one to see how that pans out, for reasons we'll come on to in the way that Spain like to set up and like to approach the game. Before we do, I want to talk about Hakim Ziyech. Ahmed, just a great story, I think you'll agree. He was frozen out by his former manager, missed out on the African Cup of Nations. He hasn't really got a ton of minutes for Chelsea so far this season, but he's had a massive role for Morocco in this tournament.
Yeah, I think these three games is the best Ziyech has played since his Ajax days. Like even in the AFCON before the last, the one that was in Egypt, he didn't play well. In these three games, it's not only about going forward and in attack down the right side. It's also defensively. I think he's putting a great shift in. And I think him alongside Sofiane Amrabat are the best Morocco players in these three games. Amrabat are just brilliant in midfield, whether marking the opponent number 10, whether dropping to help the back four, whether just screening them, whether helping with the pressing. He's been brilliant in this tournament.
Fantastic. And staying with Group F, Belgium finished third in the group. I think it's fair to say that the golden generation is now over. Roberto Martinez said in his pre-match press conference before the final game that
21 of them, they got the A licenses. This generation are going to carry on affecting Belgian football from a coaching point of view. So the next 20 years, with their progress and what they've done, they were able to build a new training facility, a state of art that is going to change Belgian football for the next generations. I think leaving a legacy goes a lot further than winning a tournament.
Is that a good point to make, Michael? Is that him getting his excuses in before the game, knowing that Belgium might have gone out, which of course they subsequently did? Or does he have a valid point there?
No, I think it's fine. In broad terms, I think you can say maybe the most influential European side of all time would be the Dutch side in the 1970s, and they didn't win the tournament. And people talk about them a lot more than any other European side who's won the World Cup. From Belgium's perspective, I'm kind of sad for them because I think they came into this tournament with a reputation as underachievers. And I think that was a little bit unfair. When you look at what they've done in the previous two tournaments, last World Cup, they went out to France, the eventual winners by one goal. The last Euros, they went out to Italy, the eventual winners by one goal. They haven't been embarrassed here. They've lost to the best team or the eventual winners by a pretty narrow margin. But I don't think there's many excuses for this tournament, really. I think they were poor from the outset against Canada. I've been amazed by the lack of cohesion between the attacking players. Batshuayi in particular was completely isolated from the rest of the team. You can see that in some of the passing networks. And I think it's kind of telling that Batshuayi scored the only goal for Belgium at this tournament, and yet the obvious solution to try and make them better was dropping him for the final group game, which didn't quite work. And I also think it's a little bit sad for, you know, people always want to find a fall guy, and it looks like that's going to be Lukaku. But, I mean, make no mistake, Belgium played their best football this tournament during the period he was on the pitch. And they really, I think, suffered during the period where he wasn't on the pitch. And he clearly wasn't really fit enough to be playing anyway. So, yeah, it's all a little bit sad, really. I think they, I'm not sure the generation's over because, let's remember, it's only 18 months until the next tournament. But they've certainly peaked. You know, the defence is quite old now. Hazard, I'm not sure we'll be seeing him being a world-class player again. So they kind of are over the hill. But yeah, I'll certainly have good memories of them, you know, from this generation. And, you know, when you compare it to what came beforehand, I mean, Belgium didn't qualify for a single tournament between World Cup 2002 and the 2014 World Cup. They were finishing fourth in their qualification group a lot of the time. So I kind of get what Martinez means. It's still been, I think, a pretty thrilling ride for anyone following Belgium.
True, and I think that Lukaku was given a unfair criticism because if you have to reach the stage where one half of football is where you completely redeem the whole group stage, then you know that you haven't done well in the rest of the game. So I completely agree. I think he was a bit of a scapegoat from yesterday's game, but certainly not down to him. We have to talk about Japan. So many twists and turns throughout the evening in Group E. There was a time when Costa Rica and Japan were going to go through, and Spain and Germany were going to go out, which is just crazy. We spoke about it before, but Japan topped the group, having beaten both Germany and Spain 2-1. They had just 17.7% of the ball against Spain, which is the lowest possession figure in World Cup history in which a side has won a World Cup game. And it looked as though it was another change at half time that was key to turning things around, Ahmed. It changed the course of the game again after it looked like it was one-way traffic in the first half.
Yeah, like before we start, I don't know why every time I hear Japan, I hear it in Sir Alex Ferguson's voice, like Japan. I think the change at halftime by bringing on Mitoma instead of Nagatomo and playing with a more attacking left wing back like mattered. It just brought the team forward and it helped. We saw Mitoma on the ball. He assisted the second goal for Tanaka. So I think this change helped them a lot. And we also saw the change in the Germany game by moving it to a back five, because in the first half against Germany, as Michael like illustrated in his piece, Germany were more of a 3-2-4-1 in possession in the first half, and just Raum dominated Japan's right side. So they had to move to a back five. And when they did, defensively, they were a bit better, despite Germany creating chances, but not in open play possession, mainly set pieces, counter-attacks and transitions. And then going forward, it was now 5 versus 4 because Germany were defending with a back four. And this helped Japan in the first game. But I think if we're going to talk about Murayasu's tinkering, I think he could have lost it in the Costa Rica game. Because in the Costa Rica game, I just want to read the subs because he didn't start all his attackers. So on the bench was Mitoma, Minamino, Kubo, Ito, Asano, and Maeda. So he didn't play any of the attackers in the Costa Rica game. And for the first half, he played with a back four against Costa Rica's back five. And I think Brian Oviedo and Joel Campbell caused him a lot of problems on the left side. And that meant that he, in the last 10 minutes, he had to change to a back five defensively, but he was still a back four on the ball. And the players he had on like were not his A team, so, and he didn't do anything. And in the second half, he changed to a back three, like in possession and out of possession. But the changes were too late. Like, I think Junya Ito and Mitoma came on around the 67th minute. So actually, he wasted an hour. And Japan looked way better when he brought on the better players, which is trivial. But they conceded the late goal. So I think Morayaso will get praise because of his changes. But I think these changes could have costed them against Costa Rica in terms of not qualifying.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, you were at the game last night. How convinced were you by Japan's performance, and how much can it go on? Them surprising and shocking people, obviously now through to the knockouts, but it on both occasions, it was good tactical tweaks, as Ahmed just said, but a little bit of a sucker punch each time. They are happy to concede possession, but do you think this is something that they could progress even further than beyond the last 16?
Yeah, I really don't know what to make of them, to be honest. I mean, in both those games against Germany and Spain, they almost didn't try in the first half. I mean, when they went 1-0 down last night, it was like both teams shook hands and said, right, let's just call it 1-0 at half time. And then they have this incredible burst of energy just after half time. The tactical changes, maybe not as sweeping changes as against Germany, because they didn't actually change the system this time around, but they made some similar substitutions in terms of the wide areas, and the subs made a great impact. I don't really know what to make of them, really. I think Morayaso is very unpredictable in terms of his selections, seems to make substitutions very well. To beat Spain and Germany in this group is just absolutely incredible. And I think in both games, you can say they did deserve it, even though they probably only played great football for a fairly short period in the second half.
Well, that's what I was going to say. With Spain, they still dominated the game in terms of possession, but I think they were fairly toothless in terms of their actual chance creation across the game. It wasn't like they were peppering the goal with shots. As we mentioned before, game state obviously massively informed the way that both sides approached the second half. But Michael, how convinced are you that Spain are still among the favourites based on the performances that they've given? It feels a little bit similar to the Euros last year, where they do just dominate the game, but then against Italy they were undone. Do you have a similar opinion of them this time round?
Yeah, I do actually. I think you're spot on. They seem to control games for long periods and then have a 5 or 10 minute spell where everything goes awry. And that's the difficult thing about football games and difficult thing about controlling football games. And you can point to previous teams who have thought of similarly, who've had a brief spell of, you know, bad football and have gone out. Brazil in 2010, I think, would be the best example of that. They were the best team in the competition for 4.5 games and then had a dreadful 45 minutes against the Netherlands, went out. So, I don't really know what to make of them. I realise that's the second time I've said that about a team progressing from this group. But what else can you say when you look at that group? It was just absolutely crazy. I still fancy Spain to go relatively far. I think they've got a great midfield. I think they can dominate possession as well as anyone. I like the rotations down the left. I won't bother explaining that because I think it's very similar to what Ahmed said earlier about the USA. But they tend to rotate down the left and be a bit more fixed down the right, Spain, which I think is quite fun. You can't rule out a 5 or 10 minute period of bad football. They've made defensive mistakes. You know, Laporte in the second game, Simon in the third game. They're not entirely solid without the ball. And I think that will probably just mean they, you know, even more emphasise the importance of retaining possession.
Actually, the whole tournament is a bit unpredictable. It's not like I can watch a team and say, yeah, that team is definitely winning. I think every big team has showed some weaknesses in their play, whether on the ball or off the ball in certain parts of the games.
But that's why we love tournament football. The perils of it you cannot predict, which is actually quite ironic because I'm going to ask you guys for some predictions. I'm going to throw it forward to just how you think the games are panning out, or at least which knockout games you're most looking forward to, as we've done in the past couple of episodes. Michael, based on everything that we've spoken about so far, which matchups are you most looking forward to seeing in the knockout rounds?
I think Netherlands against USA is going to be really interesting, actually. I think a clash of different styles. I think in historical terms, you would consider the USA big underdogs against a side like the Netherlands. But on the basis of their squads, on the basis of the way they played so far, I think this could be a really exciting game. And I think actually the USA might dominate. I think they might take the game to the Netherlands and you know, press high and try and keep possession. And maybe we'll see the Netherlands playing a little bit more reactive. I think they're relatively comfortable playing like that. It's a similar way to how they played in 2014 when I think Arjen Robben was close to the best player in the tournament. They've got Depay back. And I think with Depay and Gakpo up front, they've got speed and counter-attacking ability. So, yeah, I think that could be a really fun one.
United States building momentum at the right time, I think it's fair to say. I haven't been wholly impressed with the Netherlands, but of course they do have so many dangerous players at the top end, as you say. Ahmed, is there anyone that you've picked out as your fixture to look out for?
Yeah, Morocco-Spain. I talked about Morocco earlier. I don't think it will be an easy game for Spain. I think they'll suffer, but I think they'll win at the end. But yeah, I can't wait for the Morocco fans. Like, their support has been incredible throughout the tournament. Like, I'm watching from home, but I can hear them loudly with every ball Mrabat wins.
So many good stories of teams progressing through. Michael, Ahmed, thank you as ever for your time. To get all of the incredible World Cup coverage that Michael, Ahmed, and so many of the team at The Athletic are working hard on at the moment, then you know what to do. You can subscribe to The Athletic by going to theathletic.com/tactics. I can guarantee that there'll be something there for you, however you consume your football content. But thank you as ever for joining us today. We'll be back for the knockout round of fixtures, and I believe we'll have Ali back in the big chair for that, which I'm very much looking forward to. But in the meantime, have a great day, everybody. We'll be speaking to you again soon on the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.